The view presented here seems to contradict the fundamental teaching of modern natural science known as the theory of evolution, but it only seems to do so to be so. People understand evolution to mean the real development, according to natural laws, of what is later from what was earlier. People understand evolution in the organic world to mean that later, more perfect organic forms are real descendants of earlier, more imperfect forms, and developed from them according to natural laws. Adherents of the theory of organic evolution must actually imagine that there was once a time on Earth when a being, if it were present as an observer endowed with a sufficiently long lifespan, could have followed with its own eyes the gradual development of reptiles from proto-amniotes. In the same way, evolutionists imagine that a being, if it could have remained in an appropriate spot in the world ether during that infinitely long time, could have observed the development of the solar system out of the Kant-Laplace primordial nebula. In order to picture things in this way, however, the nature of the proto-amniotes, like the Kant-Laplace primordial nebula, would have to be thought of differently than materialists think of them. But that is irrelevant here. Evolutionists could never claim that without having ever seen a reptile, they could derive the concept of reptiles, with all their features, from the concept of protoamniotes. Nor can the solar system be derived from the concept of the Kant-Laplace primordial nebula, if that concept is understood to be directly determined only by the percept of the primordial nebula. In other words, if they think consistently, evolutionists must assert that later phases of evolution really follow from earlier ones, and that if we have the concept of the imperfect and that of the perfect given to us, we will be able to see the connection. But on no account can evolutionists affirm that the concept attained from the earlier is sufficient to develop the concept of the later from it. It follows that while ethicists can certainly see the connection between earlier and later moral concepts, not even a single new moral idea can be drawn forth from earlier ones. As moral beings, individuals produce their own content. For an ethicist, this content is just as much a given as reptiles are a given for the natural scientist. Reptiles develop from protoamniotes, but natural scientists cannot get the concept of reptiles out of the concept of protoamniotes. Later moral ideas develop from earlier ones, but ethicists cannot draw forth the ethical concepts of later cultural epochs from those of earlier epochs. The confusion arises because as natural scientists, we already have the facts before us and afterward investigate them cognitively. While for ethical action we must ourselves first create the facts that we cognize afterward. In the evolutionary process of the ethical world order, we accomplish something that on a lower level is accomplished by nature. We alter something perceptible. Thus, initially, the ethical norm cannot be cognized like a natural law. Rather, it must be created. Only once it is present can it become the object of cognition. But can we not measure the new against the old? Are not all of us forced to measure what we produce by our moral imagination against received ethical teachings? If we are to be ethically productive, this is as absurd as if we were to measure a new natural form against an old one and say reptiles are an unjustifiable pathological form because they do not match protoamniotes. Thus, ethical individualism does not contradict the theory of evolution when it is properly understood, but follows directly from it. Haeckel's genealogical tree, running from protozoa to human beings as organic beings, ought to be traceable, without interrupting natural law or breaking the uniformity of evolution, right up to the individual as an ethical being in a specific sense. Footnote: Ernst Heinrich Philipp August Haeckel, 1834 to 1919, German biologist and philosopher, the first German advocate of Darwin's theory of evolution. Haeckel formulated the famous dictum, quote, ontogeny recapitulates phylogeny, unquote. Haeckel was the first to draw up a genealogical tree relating all the various orders of animals and proposed that all life was a unity originating in crystals and evolving to humanity. End of footnote. But nowhere could we derive the nature of a subsequent species from the nature of an ancestral species. It is true that an individual's ethical ideas evolve from those of his or her predecessors, but it is equally true that individuals are ethically sterile if they lack moral ideas of their own. The same ethical individualism that I have developed on the basis of the preceding views could also be derived from the theory of evolution. The final conviction would be the same, only the path by which it was attained would be different. To the theory of evolution, the emergence of completely new ethical ideas from moral imagination is no more amazing than the development of a new animal species from an old one. But as a monistic worldview, evolutionary theory must reject, in ethics, as in science, every merely inferred, otherworldly, metaphysical influence that cannot be experienced conceptually. In so doing, it is following the same principle as when it seeks causes of new organic forms, without appeal to the interference of an otherworldly being, who, by supernatural influence, summons each new species according to a new creative thought. Just as monism cannot employ supernatural creative thoughts to explain living creatures, so likewise it cannot derive the ethical order of the world from causes lying outside the experienceable world. For monism, the moral essence of someone's will is never fully explained by tracing it back to some continuous supernatural influence on ethical life, parenthesis, divine world rule from without, parenthesis, to a specific temporal revelation, parenthesis, transmission of the Ten Commandments, parenthesis, or to the appearance of God on earth, Christ. What happens in a human being and to a human being by means of these becomes ethical only if it is appropriated in human experience by individuals who make it their own. For monism, ethical processes are products of the world like everything else that exists, and their causes must be sought in the world, that is to say, in human beings, because humans are the bearers of morality. Thus, ethical individualism becomes the pinnacle of the edifice that Darwin and Haeckel sought to build for natural science. It is a spiritualized evolutionary theory transferred to moral life. Those who narrow-mindedly confine the concept of what is natural to an arbitrarily limited region easily reach the point of not being able to find any room there for free individual action. Consistent, systematic evolutionists cannot fall into any such narrow-mindedness. They cannot close the natural path of evolution with the apes and then give humanity a supernatural origin. Evolutionists must seek the spirit too, in nature, even in the search for natural human ancestors. They cannot stop at human organic processes, finding those alone to be natural. They must also regard the morally free life as a spiritual continuation of organic life. According to their fundamental principles, theorists of evolution can claim only that present ethical behavior follows from other kinds of occurrences in the world. To characterize an action, for instance, to define it as free, must be left to immediate observation of the action itself. After all, evolutionists also claim only that humans evolved from non-human ancestors. What humans are actually like must be ascertained through observation of human beings themselves. The results of such observation cannot come into conflict with a properly understood history of evolution. Only the claim that these results were such as to preclude a natural world order could not be aligned with the current trend of natural science. Footnote: it is quite proper that we speak of thoughts, ethical ideas, as objects of observation. For even if the products of thinking do not enter into consciousness during thought activity, they can still become the object of observation afterward. It is in this way that we have been able to characterize human action. End of footnote. Ethical individualism has nothing to fear from natural science that understands itself. Observation shows that freedom is characteristic of the perfected form of human action. This freedom must be ascribed to the human will insofar as the will realizes pure conceptual intuitions. For these intuitions do not result from necessity working upon them from without. They are self-sustaining. We feel the action to be free when we find that it is the image of such an ideal intuition. The freedom of an action lies in this characteristic. From this standpoint, what can be said about the distinction made in chapter 1 between the two sentences, quote, to be free means to be able to do what one wills, unquote, and, quote, the real meaning of the dogma of free will is to be able to desire or not desire as one pleases, unquote. Question. Hemmerling based his view of free will precisely on this distinction, describing the first of these as correct and the second as an absurd tautology. He says, quote, I can do what I will, but to say that I can will what I will is an empty tautology, unquote. Whether I do transform into reality what I will, that is, what I have intended as the idea of my action, depends on outer circumstances and on my technical skill. To be free means to be able on my own, through moral imagination, to determine the mental pictures, motives, underlying an action. Freedom is impossible if something outside myself, whether a mechanical process or a merely inferred otherworldly God, determines my moral mental pictures. Therefore, I am free only when I produce these mental pictures myself, not merely when I can carry out motives that another has placed within me. Free beings are those who can will what they themselves hold to be right. Those who do something other than what they want must be driven to it through motives that do not lie within them. They are acting unfreely. To choose to will or want what I consider right or not right, therefore, means to choose to be free or unfree. But this, naturally, is just as absurd as to see freedom in the capacity to do what one has to will. Yet this is exactly what Hemmerling claims when he says that it is perfectly clear that the will is always determined by motives, but it is absurd to say that it is therefore unfree. For we can neither wish for nor think of a greater freedom of the will than for it to realize itself according to its own strength and determination. But we can wish for a greater freedom, and only then is it true freedom, namely to determine for ourselves the motive of our will. Under certain circumstances, we can be induced to refrain from what we want to do, to allow ourselves to be told what we ought to do, that is, to want what others and not we ourselves consider to be right. To this we submit only to the extent that we do not feel free. Outer forces can prevent me from doing what I will. In that case, they simply condemn me to inaction or to unfreedom. Only if they subjugate my spirit, drive my motives from my head, and replace them with their own, only then do they really intend to make me unfree. This is why the Church is not merely against actions, but particularly against impure thoughts, the motives for my actions. The Church makes me unfree when it sees as impure all motives that it has not itself decreed. A church or any other community creates unfreedom when its priests or teachers turn themselves into keepers of conscience, so that the faithful in the confessional must take the motives for their actions from them. That is the end of chapter 12, the addendum to the new edition, 1918. This discussion of human will shows what human beings can experience in their actions, so that through this experience they arrive at the awareness, quote, my will is free, unquote. It is especially significant that the justification for calling a will free comes from the experience that a conceptual intuition realizes itself in the will. This can result only from observation, and it does so only when human willing observes itself in a stream of development whose aim is precisely to make possible willing carried by purely conceptual intuition. This is achievable because in conceptual intuition, nothing but its own self-based essence is at work. Whenever such an intuition is present in human consciousness, it has not developed from the processes of the organism. Rather, organic activity has withdrawn to make room for conceptual activity. If I observe willing that is the image of an intuition, then all organic necessary activity has withdrawn from that willing. The will is free. Such freedom of will cannot be observed by someone unable to see that free willing consists in the fact that the necessary activity of the human organism is first numbed and suppressed by the intuitive element, and then replaced by the spiritual activity of the idea-filled will. Only someone who cannot make this observation of the twofold nature of a free act of will believes that all willing is unfree. Anyone who can make the observation struggles through to the insight that human beings are unfree to the extent that they cannot complete the process of restraining the organic activity, but that such unfreedom strives toward freedom, which is in no way an abstract ideal, but a guiding power inherent in human nature. Human beings are free to the extent that they can realize in their willing the same mood of soul that lives in them when they are conscious of forming purely conceptual spiritual intuitions.